How well do you know the history of one of your favorite ingredients? Welcome to Everything Cookbooks, the podcast for writers, readers, and cooks. I'm Kate Leahy, and today I'm here with Molly Stevens. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kate.
Molly, would you ever use ChatGPT or one of the other LLMs for research?
Would I ever? Have I ever? What?
Say you're writing all about braising again. If you were writing it for the first time today, would you actually say, just go ChatGPT?
What's the history of braising? No.
No. No.
Yeah, we all use ChatGPT and things like that for, you know, what's the best way to prune my tomato plants or, you know, little things like that, I'm sure. Or most of us. But to do primary research for a book, no.
Does not feel right. It hallucinates.
Yeah, it hallucinates. I mean, it's funny, I think of Kristen having this conversation with her. I mean, you could certainly use it, like consult it, but I certainly would never rely on it.
Yes, because you kind of want to know where they're drawing their conclusions from. And you want to draw your own conclusions. You don't want something to think for you, especially when you're writing it. It's different if, say, if I had a very complicated, I don't know, something like medical that I did not understand, it would be like different to say like, hey, summarize this for me. Do I need to ice my ankle or not?
Right, you know? Right.
That's different. We're not talking about that.
Well, if you're doing research with the goal of then writing something yourself that is then going to become an authority on the topic, you better know where you're getting your information, right?
Yeah, I just would not feel comfortable going anywhere near, you know, and it's not even enough to Google it. Either.
No.
So that's why I'm really excited for our conversation today, because we are talking to people who didn't just Google it.
Right.
They went straight to primary research. They did so many interviews as well to write their book.
Right. Sarah Alabak and Monique Parsons have co-authored Green Gold, The Avocado's Remarkable Journey from Humble Superfood to Toast of the Nation, which came out just a few months ago, Counterpoint Press, I believe.
Right. Sarah is an author and historian, and she specializes in architectural and landscape preservation, which is such a unique kind of specialty. She has degrees from Princeton and MIT, where she earned her doctorate in architecture, art, and environmental studies. So it's interesting to pair her with Monique, who's a journalist.
Right. Monique is a journalist, award-winning audio producer, and an avocado farmer.
Avocado farmer.
Yeah. And she has degrees from Princeton, Northwestern's School of Journalism, and the Harvard Divinity School. So quite a dynamic duo, these two.
It really is. And they happen to grow up in the same part of California where avocados are grown, in Carpinteria. Right. So that's an interesting thing. Like, you grew up around avocados and you go off and grow up and then all of a sudden you come back and write a book together. So the book that they wrote covers the history of two very important avocado varieties, the Fuerte and the Hass, and how they came into prominence through decades of work by avocado growers, botanists, and marketers. But it's also a cultural story of California and Mexico, and because our podcast is called Everything Cookbooks, there are recipes, and we're going to talk about it.
Let's bring them on.
Sarah and Monique, welcome to Everything Cookbooks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the things in your beautiful new book, Green Gold, you know, something Molly and I do often is we jump to the acknowledgement section to see who was involved in the making of this book. And in your acknowledgement section, you honor the memory of a woman who many years ago told two awkward sixth graders that they should write a book together. And now I'm assuming those two sixth graders were you, and you've written a book together.
That's right.
Tell us about how you came together to write this book.
So that woman we honored, which I appreciate you noticing that, was my mother, and she passed away in 1994. Sarah and I first met each other when we were in the third grade in the public schools of Carpinteria, California, where we both grew up. We became really good friends in sixth grade. Sarah, we just had so much fun climbing trees and coming up with little adventures and reading books like Harriet the Spy together. And whatever caused my mother to say it, she just had said, you two should write a book together one day. When this idea came to us sort of through my husband talking to me about, hey, I don't think there are any great nonfiction narrative books about avocados. Why don't you try writing that? My first thought was, I need to call Sarah and see if this is it.
And I did say no, right off the bat. And it just, I didn't see a story there particularly. I was distracted by some other freelance work I was doing. It really didn't grab me. But Monique was persistent. And gradually I thought, well, I'll give it a try. I mired myself in early horticultural history, trying to find the origins of the first avocados that came to California through the missions. We kind of agreed that that was probably the way they came. But no, nothing appeared there. We found, never have found any relationship between the missions and avocados, even now. So that didn't work, but I had already set myself up for this project. And so I started thinking about it differently. I started thinking about it as being a story, a character-driven story that would be about the origins of the industry in California specifically. How did that evolve? I had many false starts, but ultimately found the Popino family, Wilson Popino, and his father, Fred Popino, who were responsible for introducing the first major avocado from Mexico to California at a nursery called West India Gardens. Fred was a founder of the California Avocado Association. So that's all very important for me as a historian to try to be thinking of what sources can I use to write this book. And this California Avocado Association published a bi-yearly yearbook with everything that they were doing from 1915 actually to the present. And they're digitized. And so I was able to start looking at what these folks were doing beginning in 1915, finding out from that who they were, and then going backward and looking for the Popino papers, which are completely digitized by Carnegie Mellon University. And that was a huge surprise, because then that opens you up to correspondence from Wilson, who was in Florida much of the time, and to his father. And so I was able to do things like look up dates and connect it to what was happening with the association. Once I could do that, I knew this was going to be great.
So, Sarah, you're an historian.
Yes.
And an author. But for people who don't really understand the process of primary research, I mean, we just Google things, right?
Right.
You know, so you had this avocado yearbook from the Avocado Association, or 1915, but the book goes back, starts in like 1890,
right,
around then.
It flashes back even to the Aztecs.
Yes. So just talk to us about what primary research, what does that mean? And how do you like even begin to go about it?
I would have liked to have visited every archive that was available across the country, but I couldn't. I didn't have those resources. So I found my own, I won't say completely online. I did a lot of interlibrary loan for certain books that I needed. But the primary archives I was able to use were this yearbook that is digitized completely on the Hattie Trust. The Hattie Trust is a gift to everyone, and especially to people who write cookbooks. And it's a nonprofit digital archive. The contributors are universities throughout the country and major research libraries. And wow, they've digitized millions of documents, accessible digitized records of multiple cookbooks. They actually have curated cookbook collections. Wow. One of them is a 19th century collection. One of them is, they call it the African American collection. And one goes from 1820 to 1900. So those are valuable for anybody who's writing about food now to start taking a look at what they can find from the past and
absolutely
make some interesting connections, which I was able to do in the book. I use the Hattie Trust to even download complete volumes, and you can search in them. You have to learn how to do that, and it's not so easy. Well, you can't use initials, for example. I would search for avocado, alligator pear, avocate, and even pear, because when they misspelled avocado, you could get it with the pear. I spent untold hours doing that.
I'm hooked on the idea that, Sarah, you said no when Monique came to you with this idea. And Monique, how did you convince Sarah to then go down these rabbit holes and search for the Popino family?
That's so interesting. Well, one thing I know, because I know Sarah so well, no one needs to convince her to go down a rabbit hole. She is such a wonder. I mean, she's such an incredible researcher. So I not only knew and loved Sarah, but I respected her as a wonderful writer And I also know how, you know, if you get Sarah in an archive, she is going to find wonderful things. When you look at her earlier work around women in architecture in the United States and the biography she's written of women landscape architects, for example, I know how good she is. So it was just a matter of being patient and waiting for Sarah to find that treasure trove
right.
that we didn't know was out there. We hoped it was.
The thread that she could then
exactly
follow.
Yeah.
If you hadn't found the Popino family, if you hadn't found that thread in all those yearbooks with the association, could this book have happened?
Not this kind of book.
Yeah, the Hunt archive too was so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, we have to add newspapers.com, which was a major, major source.
Yeah, digitized newspapers really helped both of us too.
I would go around in circles going between HathiTrust resources and the correspondence, which lined up with the yearbooks. So you could find out what Wilson was telling his father about the meeting in 1915 across the country. He wrote about every other day. He's an amazing writer himself. And he had a long correspondence when he wasn't traveling. There were other ways that I found out how he led expeditions looking for avocados and traveled for the USDA. That is a whole nother category of archival work.
Right. And there could have been some espionage involved in there. I mean, yeah. It seems like with you have these Americans, these intrepid travelers, right? And they're just going to places claiming they're researching fruit. But they could be looking for so many other things. I mean, it was just a wild timeline.
It was. Wilson was a spy for the US Navy.
Yeah, you talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was hoping to find more on that, but he never found much, though he loved doing it.
Monique, you said something earlier about it needed to be a character-driven story, like that was the way to tell the story. And so you're a journalist, so you did a lot of the interviewing.
I did.
I mean, you interviewed dozens of experts from scientists, farmers, chefs, and just interested in that process, and even if you had some stories of some of the most significant ones.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Sarah was looking for her treasure troves. I was picking up the phone and, you know, we sort of started this during COVID. So I was making calls and, you know, as journalists do, sort of one call leads to the next. And then you try to figure out, I found some of the contacts directly by just calling our neighbors, like so I grew up on an avocado farm in Southern California near Carpinteria. Our neighbors are wonderful, you know, multi-generational avocado farmers who I'd never really talked to about their work and their history. And so it was just people, you know, you say hi to on the road or whatever, but, or you know their kids. Right. But so I just started calling and you find people in different ways. I ended up connecting with the CEO of Mission Produce, I think the world's largest avocado company, because my son was taking flying lessons and his instructor's wife knew the CEO's wife. And so they're now we're on the phone. And so I also called the Hass Avocado Board, which it comes into the story. It's a federal marketing entity. And the director of that, Emiliano Escobedo, who started in the Mexican industry before moving to this marketing industry, was also a wonderful source. I mean, some of my favorite interviews, one, Mary Lou Arpaia, who's a professor at the University of California at Riverside, is an incredible expert. She's devoted her whole career to produce and avocados in particular. And she's a special expert in post-harvest handling of fruit. So anything from sort of tree to table, what happens during that time is, I think we tend to think of avocados as pretty hardy and indestructible with their thick skin, but you have to actually treat them gently and it matters what temperature they're transported at, et cetera. I followed her through orchards and I went to her lab and did a tasting. I got to participate in an avocado tasting that she runs out of a lab in Central California to try to understand. They're always trying to bring new varieties online. And so figuring out when they're the best and what texture people like. And so that was super interesting too.
Monique, my favorite was your interview of Marian Popino, Wilson's daughter in Guatemala. Yeah.
Yes.
And that is a great narrative thread we have to be able to pass on between the two parts of the book.
Yes. And I forget, I think Sarah must have found out about her and that she was still living in Guatemala and she's a retired archaeologist. I tracked her down and was able to have a phone call with her. She was absolutely delightful. And she told me that there's still a Fuerte avocado tree, the kind of that first famous avocado that her father and grandfather had brought up from Mexico. And there's still one there in Guatemala near their family home, and she enjoys its fruit every year. And she talked also about some of her archaeology and finding charred avocado seeds at these Mayan archaeological sites that sort of showed they were being used, the pits of avocados were being used almost as like as coals.
Well, because the oil content, they burn really slowly,
oil,
you talk
and they're
about.
So dense, exactly. Yeah. She was a delight. That was a really fun one. And another, Ellen Brokaw, who is the wife of the founder of Brokaw Nursery, and actually herself is a founder of Brokaw Nursery, which is really, I think, the world's most significant avocado nursery, and has sites now in Spain and Jalisco, Mexico, as well as here in California. And she's in her 90s, and she was full of stories. So I loved interviewing the 90-year-old women who had seen so much.
Absolutely.
Well, I would imagine they, especially Marion Popenoe and Brokaw, to know their stories being told.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Because they have all this story. Yeah.
That's right. And I think, you know, so much, as you mentioned, you know, you can Google avocado and there's so much out there, but there's also a lot of things that just get repeated. A lot of things are wrong. And so it was really a joy for both of us, especially to tell the stories of women that had been overlooked, and these experts who weren't in the spotlight.
Actually, let's get into some of the avocado facts that you dug up. When you read the story, you realize how much we take for granted that avocados are available across the country and that people know what they are. But I mean, we could be looking at a fruit called the alligator pear that nobody wants to eat. I mean, this was not sort of like a surefire success story right out of the gate. I mean, what were some of the most memorable like facts that you found about avocados? You're like, well, I had no idea.
One of them was finding out that avocado toast dated back to 1915, which was served actually at the first meeting of the California Avocado Association.
What a fun discovery.
Yeah. And the association handed out a little folder with recipes that you can replicate. This is a fact that AI hasn't picked up on, and nor has the New York Times. The New York Times had 1920 as the date for avocado toast. And one of my little sort of greedy success stories is that I found out that what they had done is they had gotten a reprint of the 1915 recipe from a 1920 newspaper.
Oh.
And so they just took the newspaper as being legit and didn't look into it further. But that had come 5 years earlier from the association. So that's the kind of nitty gritty that keeps you going on a book like this.
So it wasn't Gwyneth Paltrow who came up with it?
Or the Australians? Because I think that was another like rumor.
No, that's what my nephew, he was sure. It's got to be the Australians. It's so funny. Yeah. Everyone has their idea about it.
Right.
But when you realize it's more than 100 years old, it also makes you want, I would imagine it would make a person writing a cookbook want to delve backward to try to see how they were serving it, what they were serving it with, how they, the attitudes of that, and then start to maybe even adapt their recipes. I have one source from the 1880s that comes from a chef called Thomas Murray. He wrote a little book about salads, and avocados were in that. He said that they tasted a lot like chestnuts, which started me thinking about my experience with a chestnut that grew on our property and that I roasted without salt. And I absolutely agree. I think that beats the taste test that Monique participated in, right, at Riverside, where everyone said that it was like mushrooms. Anyway, so finding out about the chestnut flavor, it just, to me, I thought, wow, try some avocados and chestnuts together. Mix it up a little, or, you know, start looking for ways that you can garnish them. There's so many possibilities, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad you brought up the recipes, because every chapter in the book starts with a recipe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're photographed or printed in such a way that they look like they've come right from the original material. So, like, how you selected the recipes you used, and really, more importantly, what role they play in telling the story of the avocado?
The biggest role for me is it makes the book more accessible. And I knew from the beginning that if we were going to sell this book, my half had to be equivalent to Cartels and Icon and all of this jazzy stuff. So what was I going to do? well, recipes, everyone loves to read them. Everybody wants to read about food too. So one thing I do in the book is try to discuss food in depth. Like, what are they eating? I've always wondered that in books. I want to know everything from beginning to end. Even though I'm not particularly interested in making the recipe, maybe, I want to know what people were eating. I think everyone does. It's sort of a human desire. And so I thought, well, if you have a recipe starting it off, you also get more space in the book when you're looking through. So that was kind of a technical choice, along with a lot of other choices, like the two parts and having a picture for each tree. The map that was basically our, it was all our idea to do this kind of thing. That just, it welcomes people in a good way. And then choosing them involved often a topic we were focused on in the book, but not always. Sometimes it was just sort of like, okay, West India Gardens had a brochure with a early recipe and we needed to emphasize that. So we're going to pick that one. Monique, you chime in with what was inspiring for your half. Mine tended always to be an angle on the history.
Yeah, because and the book is structured roughly chronologically. So we were looking for recipes. Each recipe kind of speaks to that time period. So it's kind of, it's really fun, I think, to see how different recipes evolved. So, you know, writing the book in two parts, and we worked very hard. We can maybe talk about this in a minute about the collaboration, but Sarah primarily wrote the first half of the book and I primarily wrote the second. But when you get through the 50s and 60s, you start to see these wild recipes with avocados. Like Calavo put out a cookbook, Calavo being the first major avocado company in the country. They put out a cookbook in 1967 that is just filled with a lot of recipes that you would think of in the 60s, but they're trying to substitute avocado for things like cream or butter, or, you know, they're in, it's in baked Alaska and things like that.
And that actually goes way back. They were even doing it in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. Crazy desserts. You wouldn't believe. Like, I can't even begin to discuss them. They're so elaborate, but they're all in the book.
Avocado ice cream is
forever. Oh, yeah. 1915, again, that was also served at that the first meeting.
Wow.
And by 1930, there were, I believe, 28 creameries selling avocado ice cream in the Los Angeles area.
But I tried also, I tried, as Sarah did, to look for recipes that reflected the theme of a chapter. So one chapter is all about marketing and how avocados eventually became sort of tied to the millennial generation and things like avocado toast. And so there was a bar in New York that was making an avocado toast cocktail where they blended avocados with vodka and then organic vodka and then strained it. Strained it. You dip the rim of the glass in toast crumbs or something. And it was just fun to see what people were coming up with. And then one of the challenges, so there was, Sarah mentioned cartels. There is a chapter looking at the violence that avocado industry in Mexico has been subject to and has to navigate around. It's like, how in the world am I going to find a recipe that deals with violence in Mexico? But I ended up having a wonderful interview with Rick Bayless, the chef based in Chicago. And it turns out that he had been invited by President Obama to cook at President Obama's first state dinner of his term. And it happened to be with the president of Mexico. And of course, they talked about cartel violence, among other things. So I was able to use a version of Rick Bayless's recipe to start off that chapter and then kind of help ease into the story that way. So the recipe really helped me shape the chapter now that I think about it.
Was that also the chapter where you quote the Chicago Sun-Times headline about all the kilos of cocaine that were smuggled in guacamole?
Yes, exactly.
And I think the headline was Holy Guacamole.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. There was a bricks of cocaine inside frozen avocado pulp. Yeah.
Oh my! And then the person who discovered the bust, he could not look at guacamole the same.
Right. It's like, I never want it again.
Ever again.
Ever again.
Yes.
So that's the thing about this book. There's so many layers. There's so many tidbits. I mean, any kind of person who likes to impress people at a cocktail party, they read this book and they can be able to tell you about the Haas tree. I mean, I had no idea about the story of the Haas avocado and how it's kind of amazing that it is the dominant avocado that we eat today, because it didn't stand out back when it was first discovered and it might have just never been grown. It could have just been pulled out of the ground right then.
Exactly.
But you have a lot about Haas and Mr. Haas did not really make any money off of having an avocado named after him.
Yeah. And I think we tried to keep putting ourselves in that mindset, because when something is so ubiquitous now, it's hard to imagine that there was a time where, like, of course, this was not preordained, that this was going to happen that way. And so you had asked about what are some of the interesting avocado facts we learned. You know, one is that, you know, there are more than 1,000 named varieties of avocados. Right. And you plant a seed. We tend to say they're like people. You plant a seed and you never know what characteristics are going to come from that tree and that fruit. They'll bear some of the characteristics of the parent tree, but it's not assured. So you use grafting techniques to replicate a certain variety that you want to keep. But, you know, the Haas survived because it does have some great qualities for the industry. It's got that nice thick skin that ships well. It has a seed that pops out pretty nicely. Sarah and I have been trying different varieties at some of our book talks. We partner with Brokaw Ranches, which they still grow a great variety of avocados as part of their founder sort of experimentation days. And, you know, some of the seeds are, they get stuck inside or they're really huge and there's very little pulp. And so they're all a little bit different, but the Haas is nice in that way. And it tastes really good. And the trees are pretty prolific. But it was very controversial at the beginning whether that one was going to be the one, because it had competition. And also there was great concern that Americans would not eat a black avocado, an avocado that turns black when ripe, that they would think it had gone rotten. And because the prevailing kind, the Fuerte, stays green when ripe. And then people might have seen avocados from Florida, most of which stay green, and the sort of West Indian variety. So it surprised us, I think, how much work it took for these people to kind of champion a variety that then, as they were watching, we saw in these yearbooks, there would be reports every year about productivity of different varieties. And little by little, the Haas started to lead until 1973. It became the dominant variety in the orchards in California.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you mentioned the work that it took, because, I mean, honestly, before I read this book, I mean, I guess if you would ask me, are there different varieties or a lot of different varieties of avocados, I'd probably say, I guess, but you don't, and unlike something like apples or oranges that we're used to seeing, we see maybe one or two, or, depending on where we shop. But the work that the avocado industry put into trying to influence the way the avocado was perceived. And I mean, in 1978, I think you tell us that only 25% of Americans even knew what an avocado mm-hmm. was. That's remarkable, right? Yeah. And so I guess I'm asking about how the avocado industry, all the efforts behind marketing and reaching consumers, you know, talked about Mr. and Mrs. Consumer back in the 50s, and, you know, how important that was to the survival of the avocado market, really.
Yeah. We both saw, looking both in the archives and then speaking to people and looking at some of the more recent studies even today, that the avocado industry is very focused on educating the consumer, because they know it takes some knowledge and some work to understand when they're ripe and how to store them in your kitchen. And even now you'll see on the internet, on social media, there'll be all these ways like, oh, here's how you keep your avocado ripe. And some of them are not at all true.
I have to chime in here, because way back in 1915, again, that folder of recipes also talked about the gentle hand pressure to see when it was ripe. Right. That long ago, they were working. Education was one of the main goals. From the beginning, they knew they need to educate in order to sell it.
And when did they discover that people wanted a ripe avocado? Talk about that.
It was sort of a few things started happening at once. Some of the folks in the industry, and Steve Barnard, who I mentioned earlier, the CEO of Mission Produce, when he was getting started, this was one of his ideas. And there were others we talk about in the book that were very influential. But so he sort of came across the idea of, gee, I wonder what would happen if we tried to sell ripe avocados to consumers rather than the hard, unripe green ones that was the typical way. And so the University of California, Riverside, they got a few crates of avocados. They waited till they were ripe. And you can also, and this is used today, they use ethylene, which is a natural gas that fruit emit to help them ripen. So they can artificially introduce ethylene and help the avocados ripen more quickly. But they went to a grocery store in Riverside, California, and they put out a section of ripe avocados and a section of unripe and just stood there for a few days and watched what happened. And I think, I forget the exact number, but you know, over 90% of the people chose the ripe avocados, and they interviewed them afterwards. And it was it was really fascinating because people just said there was like an urgency that people felt of like, I can't wait. I mean, oh my goodness, you know, I want it now. And why hadn't they thought of this sooner? So it was a huge game changer for the industry. And that study sort of gave them some of the data they needed to back up like, hey, this is really a good idea.
It's so interesting that all this work, I mean, this is decades and decades of work to then have something that's become sort of ubiquitous at grocery stores across the country. And I feel like a lot of food writers get sort of side gigs. I know I have like writing recipes for a board, whether that's, you know, the strawberry people or the raisin people or the prune people or whatnot. So all that does add up. There's no real overnight success in produce, it seems. Yeah. But over time, if you look back, you're like, wow, there was a lot of groundwork. And now it feels like an overnight success. It's pretty remarkable.
And how recipes, I think, Kate, what you say, how recipes do the work. Like recipes change people's behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Hass Avocado Board, this federal marketing agency, which has millions and millions of dollars every year because they take an assessment off of every pound of avocado sold. And they have a lot of money and they've been using it to fund health research and to also communicate directly with nutritionists. So what you're saying, it has me realizing like, oh, yes, of course, they're also hiring chefs to establish interesting recipes so that they can then give the nutritionists ideas of how you can use avocados in a healthy way, like in smoothies or as a substitute for butter sometimes, or in, you know, their desserts where avocado is substituted for cream because of its oil content and consistency.
Oh, remember Bob Berg recommended to substitute avocados for carafes of olive oil
on a table. Yeah.
And there was the whole controversy, right, between the olive people and the avocado people, and they kept like battling on who had the better fat.
Right. I think, yes. And that the avocado people were very upset that they were seen as like a too high, high caloric food and fattening. And then they finally got the word out that it's actually a very healthy fat too.
It's very interesting if you just listening to you both, Monique and Sarah, speak and about how attitudes around food and everything, how things change. I mean, you think about the marketing campaign with Angie Dickinson in a sexy outfit or the bikini giveaway. That worked at one point, you know. But now getting the health and nutrition, getting the American Heart Association on board was a huge boon for the avocados. Yeah. And so how, like, the recipes in a way haven't changed, but it's how they're being framed and how they're being promoted.
Yeah. Right. And I think now, you know, when they did this bikini giveaway in this ad, this was with the California Avocado Commission, another marketing agency in the late 60s, early 70s. But now, because, you know, it was only in 1997 that Mexican avocados were allowed into the United States. There had been a quarantine for 80 years because of a pest concern in Mexico. The USDA established this very elaborate system for screening orchards and packing houses in Mexico. But so over 10 years, beginning in 1997, Mexican avocados started coming in. And now that's also why they're ubiquitous. But I think some of these recipes are aimed at people who understand that, oh, I can go to any grocery store just about now and get a fruit and know how to use it. But I've had a number of nutritionists come up to me and at book talks, or whatever, and talk about like, oh, have you heard of the Love One Today website, because they have great recipes. And I was like, that's the Hass Avocado Board. Like they're doing their work.
So interesting. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of writing this book as a team. Sarah, you took the first half. Monique, you took the second half. At what point did this manuscript come together? How did you actually put together the story?
We were very fortunate to have many what we called narrative threads that began in mine and crossed over. The biggest one being obviously the Hass avocado. Also, most of these characters lived a pretty long time. I mean, Wilson Popino lived until 1975, and his book was even quoted at the World Avocado Congress in New Zealand, which Monique attended, by experts saying that his book about tropical fruit trees, the avocados plays a big role in the book, and maybe 90 pages of a manual of tropical fruit that he wrote in 1920, that is still called upon by experts today, which is kind of amazing. And those kinds of links, finding people who are looking for wild avocados in Guatemala and other places, finding out that those people then picked it up later when they worked for Riverside or a university and that they crossed it over, you know, into the other part. I was very cognizant of the fact that my section could seem boring. And so just because of history, you know, the time span that people have is limited now. And so there were chunks where I needed to talk about the history of the USDA or the experimental testing stations or big themes. How do you get that in quickly and then move on to the story? So we did actually a lot of shifting. You might have noticed in the two parts where if I had a puzzling bit that wasn't working in mine, I'd give it to Monique. And if she had one, I'd take it. One of them was the pollination of the flowers.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating.
So I ended up moving it. It moved into mine, but originally it was in yours. Do you remember? There was just a lot of that. I do think that that was crucial to having this story be engaging. You had to kind of literally say, I'll admit, I went through and put bees by boring.
Yeah.
I go bee, bee, bee. And then I'd say, okay, mix it up. Oh, or have a character tell that part. So the best example of that is the story of how the avocado got its name, which is very complicated. And I had that omnisciently in there. And it was just, oh, what am I going to do? I want to communicate this, but how? Yeah. And then I was able to have Thomas Shedden, who had been a former hotel chef and was president of the association. He talked about this and I was able to get him to be the agent. He comes up later too. So there was a lot of back and forth between the two with sections of the book and then each within our own part, kind of figuring out strategies to keep the action going.
Another part, Hank Brokaw, who I mentioned, who founded Brokaw Nursery, he developed a really completely game-changing way of grafting avocado rootstock. So every it matters what, at least in California, it matters what kind of avocado rootstock you're attaching your Hass avocado to, because you want one that's going to thrive in the soils here or in the climate here. But it was very cumbersome to clone avocado rootstock. So he developed, in the end of the day, it's a pretty simple method, but he was looking at what scientists have been doing and he came up with a little tool that made all the difference. But that was another one where, you know, I could write about that for pages because I find it so interesting, but it's like, oh no, we're going to lose the reader here. So, but fortunately, his wonderful son, Rob, who runs the nursery now, had given Sarah and me a tour of the nursery. And we met this wonderful woman, Consuelo Mendez, who's in the book, who's worked there for 50 years grafting avocado trees. And we were both able to explain the sort of complicated horticultural process by describing her doing it. And also by, you know, just we knew what it was like inside the nursery and sort of painting a scene. You know, in terms of working together also, you know, we didn't know where it was going at the beginning. We're like, is this going to be thematic? At one point, we briefly thought of, you know, is each chapter the story of a different kind of avocado? And ultimately, we decided to go chronologically and then structure it around the story of these two important trees, the Fuerte and the Hass. And that kind of opened everything up and allowed us to keep that narrative thread going forward. But we talked constantly. We shared our text constantly. And then, like Sarah said, we made a lot of decisions about where should this piece land. And with, of course, with our editor's help, our editor at Counterpoint, Dan Lopez, also gave us some ideas. I remember at one point, Rudolf Hass dies in the 50s. And I just kind of mention it and move on. And then Popino died in the 70s. Same thing. I'm like, and he's like, his notes were like, no, 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 you can't kill off your main characters and move on so quickly.
Yeah.
So that was helpful.
In the reading of it, I don't think Kate and I even thought there were distinct voices.
Nobody has. That's the beauty of it. We're so happy.
Yeah, we're always so happy to hear that because that was one of our major concerns because we do.
Yeah.
We do have different writing styles, but we worked very hard to make it seem like one voice.
Yeah. We also took out over 10,000 words.
Yeah.
It was interesting when we pitched the book, several potential publishers said, oh, we love the idea, but it's only going to be long enough for an article.
Yeah.
No way.
No way. That's what we said.
How did you pitch the book? Did you have a structure in mind when you pitched it? Do you have a full proposal? Did you have sample chapters? And did that stay true?
We had all of that, but it really completely changed. I think initially we might have had 8 chapters, but I decided we had to have 18 to make it, again, accessibility, even on the chunks.
Shorter
and
chapters.
Then plus you get 18 recipes, which is what we loved. I mean, the recipe research was my dessert. It was the most fun. for me. I kind of got obsessed with it.
We wrote a really long proposal initially, and Sarah, because I'm the journalist that works only on deadlines, so of course Sarah's wonderful prose was on paper before mine was. And so I think we ultimately put in like two chapters. Like I was able to pull something together. Our proposal was pretty long. And when we pitched it around to different agents, one of the agents who returned our call quickly was one that Sarah had found, Stacey Glick from Distel Goderich and Breaux. And she'd represented an author who did an avocado cookbook back in 2015.
Oh. Absolutely Avocados by Gabby Dalkin. Yeah.
No yeah. Way. And Sarah was like, huh, let's just try her. And like, it was like out of the slush pile. She called us immediately. It
no
was
way.
Like, and I really
12
give
hours
Sarah
later. I'll never forget it.
Wow.
For finding that.
So complete proposal, completely written, you know, you had this very concrete idea and then you sent it out to different agents. Saw,
exactly.
You know, just to see who could. Yeah. So you weren't, say, finding the agent, then writing the proposal.
Exactly. We knew what we were doing. We had this general vision. And so we had done a lot of work already before sending it out. I mean, we worked for a full year before sending it out, maybe longer, right, Sarah?
Yeah, which I think is actually a very short time. We knew that we needed to get this book out, but if I could do it, could have done it again, or if I was working 20 years ago, I would have wanted to spend 10 years.
Yeah, same. I mean, there's just so much more we could have done.
But we needed it to come out now.
You needed it to come out now because someone else was going to write it?
That's what we were worried about.
Because of the avocado's popularity now, and we didn't want to lose the moment.
Right. Mm.
Luckily, it's still going strong. But if we were bringing this out 5 years from now, I don't think that would be the case.
Who knows, right?
Who knows?
Right. It took 4 years, though, to write the book. Is that right?
It did. It took the whole process from idea through the editing process was 4 years. Our agent did give us some great advice on the proposal because I was listening to one of your episodes about writing. I don't know. It was like focused on writing cookbook proposals, but I was like, oh my gosh, what a tremendous amount of work that is to write a cookbook proposal. Cause you also have to think of the artistic vision. And there's just so much that goes into that, but she helped us by helping us make a much shorter proposal and really focusing in on those comps, which I know you guys have been good about mentioning to your listeners, because she wanted us to list comparable titles that have sold well within the last 5 years. And one of the things that we learned is that a lot of these sort of micro histories, nonfiction narratives about food in particular have not come out in the last 5 years. It's not, it's not the hip trend of the moment. And books about food are often by people with enormous platforms, whether they're chefs or influencers or social media stars. Right. And so we labored to find books that we could compare. And some of them were food books, but others were books about history or books, you know, about historical figures, because we were trying to position our book in a category that was, it's definitely a food history, but as we said, it's also a narrative history about America.
It's cultural history.
Yeah, right. Cultural history. There's a lot about U.S.-Mexico relations that we find really interesting, that I think it would be a worthwhile book for anyone studying and interested in that topic, the borderlands and all of that. People don't tend to look at history through the lens of a fruit, but when you do, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Is Green Gold been the title? Was that your working title or is that a...
It was. Yeah, we had the title from the beginning. Our subtitle was initially The Story of the Avocado's Rise to Fame, which we still like, but the editor came up with a sort of a longer, different subtitle, which is still lots of fun. It talks about avocado becoming toast of a nation, which people love that.
It's clever. Yeah. Well, just thinking the thing about how long-lived some of these characters have been, I can't help but thinking that's because they've all been eating avocados their entire life.
That's a really good question. Yes.
Talk about a good marketing, like, that, hey, you want to live a long time? Grow and eat avocados.
That's a really good. I didn't find that. Yes.
Yeah. As we're wrapping up our conversation, what were you both striving for when writing this book? And do you feel like you achieved it?
I was striving for a book no one would want to put down. Just a really good read.
Yeah, we both were. I mean, I think as a journalist, any writer, you spend all this time and you want people to find it a good story. And I think Sarah had to talk me down every now and then because, you know, we do grow avocados on our farm in California. We have a few acres and in a way I am part of the industry. And so every now and then I would get very concerned about offending someone, or what if something's wrong and my neighbors are going to be mad at me? Like when you start doing something that gets really personal, it can get in your head. And Sarah helped me, you know, take a deep breath and step back and realize, like, no, we're here to tell a story. And there are so many stories that could be told about the avocado, but this is the one that we are doing. So
I just can't stop thinking about you both in sixth grade. Just to think that you came back together to write a book about a fruit that you grew up around is really kind of like a full circle moment.
Yeah, I really can't believe it, actually.
I know.
In retrospect.
It was a lot of work and it was a lot of fun. And I think we both shed tears at a couple points along the way, but then as writers do. But yeah, it's been really a joy to see it, how it's been received. And it's a joy to be talking to you both.
And I just think it's such an amazing example how we take our ingredients for granted, but we don't understand. I mean, I imagine Kate and I were talking about this before. There are many, many other ingredients that have equally compelling tales, but you've told a wonderful story, and it was, I mean, I couldn't put it down.
Oh, that's so nice to hear.
And it does definitely want to make you, you know, go out and get as many avocados as you can get your hands on.
And it makes me wonder, you know, there are very few cookbooks that specify what kind. And, you know, some are creamier and some are firmer and some are a little sweeter. And so opening up chefs' minds to, like, well, let's try a seasonal avocado in this one and a different variety and see how those act in different recipes, just as we do with, you know, apples or other kinds of potatoes, other kinds of fruit and vegetables that we're accustomed to knowing have different varieties.
An interesting full circle, like the beginning of the industry, they were trying to narrow it down to one type so consumers wouldn't be confused.
Yeah.
And now I wonder if we're getting to a moment where now it's time where we can open it up and we could go to our markets and find more than one type of avocado.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Monique and Sarah, thank you so much for coming on Everything Cookbooks. This has been such a delightful conversation. And Molly and I now know how to do our primary research a little bit more thoroughly.
Great. Well, thank you. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to today's show. If you have a question, a comment, or a guest suggestion, contact us at everythingcookbooks.com. We rely on listener support, and here are ways to help. You can subscribe to our newsletter at everythingcookbooks.substack.com. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps people find the show. Order books mentioned on the show through our affiliate page at bookshop.org. You can shop t-shirts, sweatshirts, and other great merch, or buy us a round of coffee. You can also reach out for advertising on the show or becoming a sponsor. Thanks, as always, to our editor, Abby Circutella. And until next time, keep on writing, reading, and cooking.